This is Anthony Iannarino, and you're listening to In the Arena. Step into the arena. It's no secret that the people that succeed in any endeavor do things different than the group of people that doesn't succeed at the same level. They have different ideas, different beliefs. They make certain distinctions, and those beliefs and distinctions allow them to take a different set of actions, and those actions are what leads to success. So I found a new report called What Winners Do Differently, The Surprising Difference Between Sellers Who Win the Sale and the Second Place Finishers, by the Rain Group. And I asked Mike Schultz, the president of Rain Group, to join us here to talk about their research. They evaluated 700 purchases totaling $3 billion in sales. So I asked Mike to share their findings. I asked him to talk about whether or not solution selling is dead, whether relationship selling is dead, and you know I believe that that's not true, why you still need to pitch and persuade even though you've been told not to, and where their research conflicts with the challenger sale model. So let's get into it with Mike Schultz of Rain Group in the arena. Hey, Mike, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, Anthony?
Great. Thanks for being here. So I've got about five or six questions here about your new report. What sales winners do differently? The surprising differences between sellers who win the sale and the second place finishers. So I love that. So you're looking at people who still did pretty well. They were still in the game. And they were beaten by somebody who did a few things different. So let me start by just having you frame this up for us. Why did you decide to do such an extensive survey, number one? And what makes this survey different than some of the other surveys that we've seen and some of the things that you guys at Rain have done in the past?
Yeah, sure. So why do this now? I would say the last 40 years in the world of selling approaches and selling methods, it's been a quiet place. You know, late 70s, mid-70s, solution or consultative selling started to become a part of the common parlance and take over from feature and benefit selling, and it was working great. It was this major revolution, and it changed everything. However, if you look at the last 30 years, it's just been variations on that theme. In the last 5 years or so, however, given the Great Recession and as well a whole bunch of other changes in technology, the internet, for the first time in a long time, selling has changed a lot. And the things that people were doing 4, 5, 6 years ago, they just weren't working as well. So there's also been a lot of noise in the selling method world about, well, now you should do this, now you should do that, different types of competing research. So we thought we would take our own snapshot. And the snapshot we want to take a look at is what's working today. There are a lot of ways to skin the research cat, and one of the ways that we like to do research is to look at it from the buyer perspective. So we studied 700 purchases in business to business, and these purchases were from buyers that represented $3.1 billion in products and services purchased in the last year. And so we want to know, for these major purchases, can they describe what the seller did and how the seller interacted with them in the process compared to, this is the seller that won, compared to the seller that came in the closest second? And you said they did pretty well, except they did pretty well and they got nothing.
Right.
Absolutely nothing. This is an integer game. You either get the one or the zero. So we wanted to know not just what the winners did, but what they did differently that separated them from the second place finisher that had them, you know, walk away with the grand prize. As to your other question about how is this different, well, there's all sorts of different ways to go about research. You can ask sales managers to describe their salespeople. You can look at top performers, say, from an annual perspective and compare them. You know, that's whether or not they hit or beat their quotas. compared to the ones that don't hit or beat their quotas or in a different part of the whole bell curve, and find out, you know, how do people describe them differently. We wanted to take a little bit more of a behavioral look from buyers, because you know what? They're the ones that voted with their dollars, and it's their perceptions that really matter. And so that was just our particular spin on it.
I like that spin. There's a couple things. One, people get angry when I say selling is a blood sport, because the language is unnecessarily provocative. But it is a zero-sum game. The guy that came in second place or the girl that came in second place did well but still got nothing for doing it. So it's something that we have to be very, very certain that what we do works, because we sometimes only get one bite at that apple. The second thing I just want to comment on is the fact that you went to buyers. And there's this story about Einstein talking to Heisenberg and saying something to the effect of, we tend to base theory on observable facts alone, and that's nonsense because the theory is what decides what you're observing. So when you go to the sales manager and say, what do you think is working, you're getting that view, and it's only his view because that's the part of it that he sees. And so going to the buyers is, I think, a very different view than a lot of surveys get. When we ask the sales manager or salespeople what they think they're doing, I think we're getting it through their theory and their framework. So I like this this approach. One other thing, let me set up another question with this. I don't believe that solution selling is dead, and you mentioned methodologies, and personally I think there's a difference between a sales process and a methodology, and I think some of what I read is criminal negligence, but especially when people say solution selling is dead and then offer, instead of a process, a methodology. And I think that solution selling covers from target to close. There's a methodology for each area, and that you could bolt a different methodology into, say, how you ask questions in a diagnosis or a needs analysis. So that might be spin selling as a methodology. But it's a methodology doesn't replace a whole sales process. And you discovered that solution selling isn't dead, but there have been changes. Can you share some of the changes that you found in your research of what's changed in solution selling, and how do sellers now have to adapt?
Well, sure. And one of the things that has brought, you know, the end of solution sales into the mainstream discussion is when the Harvard Business Review just a few months ago published an article called "The End of Solution Sales." Now, that's not the end of solution sales sometimes. It's not the end of solution sales situationally. It was pretty definitive, the end of solution sales. And so once something gets into the Harvard Business Review, it may or may not be right, but it's certainly a part of mainstream discussion. It's not something crazy off on the side. So the question is that indeed the case? Because, hey, solution selling, and I don't mean the branded solution selling,
right,
I mean
right.
Lowercase, the concept of uncovering needs and taking your products and services and matching those up as solutions to those needs as sort of a baseline concept, you know, that's what people have in their mind when it comes to solution selling and solution sales. And so we did our research. And by the way, I understand why some people might say that. Well, if we've been doing solution sales for, you know, years and years and years, and it's not working anymore, we should replace it with something else. It's a plausible point to begin a debate. But that's not what we found. So when we did our research and we looked at what the winners did and what they did differently and what the buyers perceived to be important, because we looked at the research from a number of different angles, a couple of things jumped out at us. One of them was that the seller listened to me and that the seller connected with me personally. He showed up in a number of different spots. So there's not just solution sales is dead, but there's also articles out there saying the end of relationship selling, or selling is not about relationships. Well, we found that listening, connecting with them personally, is also themes of trust and perception of value were huge, huge importance. And are those the be-all, end-all points in relationships? No, but they're pretty core points, and so I don't think that's a great point.
I'll stop you there for one second. I disagree with the whole idea that relationship selling is dead, and I think if you sell, you know that that's not true. But I think what you're saying there is that it's got to be relationships of value. So it's not enough just that we're friendly and we like each other and we've got this connection. It's got to be a connection around something more than that.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, there is a famous quote in sales that says, "Be liked and you'll never want." That was from Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman. Death of a Salesman, I believe, was published in 1949. Now, it didn't say Willie Loman, the sales rep of all time that beats his quota, it says death of a salesman. So, you know, let's go back to 1949 and say that relationships by themselves, friendship, generous giving of time, you know, these are not the kinds of things that win you sales. Now, if someone doesn't like you, you can have all other great things in order. But all other things being equal, if someone can get the value from someone else, they're going to pick the one that they like over you. So it's not the core of what gets you the win. But if you don't have it, you probably lose. And so I agree with you. The relationships are alive and well. But the other thing we found from a baseline perspective was two major factors that came up over and over again in the research were that the sellers that won, the buyer said they understood my needs and they crafted a compelling solution. It was the case. They did it more often than the sellers that came in second place. And as well, when the sellers came in second place, we asked the buyer and didn't do something. We asked the buyers, all right, well, if they were to do better in this area, how much more likely would you have been to consider buying from them over the winner? And sometimes they said if they did better in this area, it doesn't really matter at all. But other times they'd say if they did better in this area, it would have a huge impact on whether or not I would consider purchasing them. So when the seller didn't do this, they lost. And the buyer said they were really important. So understood my needs and crafted a compelling solution. These are a core part of sales success today. And to say that you know the end of solution sales, I think is doing companies a disservice. And I think that if someone takes it at face value, if they literally kick it to the curb, I think that they're putting their sales success, which means they're putting families and careers and health insurance and investors, I actually think they're putting all of that success at grave risk. Things that we found that change in solution sales, selling used to be a lot about diagnosis. You read that in a lot of different pieces of sales advice. The buyers weren't so into diagnosis, and the sellers that won didn't do it that much more often than the sellers that lost. But understanding of my needs was important. So the buyers were looking for sellers that got it. They didn't want to leave the meeting and say, I'm not sure they really got what we were trying to do. So you have to understand needs, but diagnosis is not important. The second one is that this concept of just focusing on problems and pain. If you were to say to someone, what are the most common words associated with needs discovery? Well, it's figuring out the problem, figuring out the pain. That was really only half the story that we found. The other half was that the sellers that won were just as likely to focus on the flip side. The aspirations, the goals, the possibilities, educating on new ideas and perspectives, bringing forth things to the table that the buyers might not have been thinking about, or as we call, you know, setting the agenda for something new. So the sellers that won were much more likely to drive their own demand than the sellers that came in second place.
That all makes sense to me, too. I mean, and I hear all these ideas. We read a lot. There's so much going on out there in the world of sales, and the internet's brought it all right to you. And it says things like buyers are 67% through the buying cycle, or 57%, or 177% in some. I don't know how they come up with the number. But I don't think it's the internet that's got them there. I think it's that they're sophisticated buyers. They're buying by consensus. They've done a lot of buying of whatever it is that you sell, and they have some idea what they want, and they want to share that with somebody who goes, okay, I get it. Now let's figure out how we can help you get what you want now that you know what would have to work inside your organization. So I think that that's one thing that it resonates with me. The second part of that is this idea of persuading them that they were the right choice and the right solution. And again, we get so much of this, you've got to be unbiased. You've got to be consultative, which means a trusted advisor, and no pitching. And your survey revealed that persuading the client that you did understand what they need, that you do have the right idea and the right solution to make a difference, and that you were the best choice was part of what winners do differently. And maybe I didn't frame that up exactly like the survey said, but can you share more about that?
Yeah, sure. So you pretty much hit it on the head just right. in my experience, not necessarily in this research, but just in working with sellers, especially in sellers where trust is really important, strategic account managers, sellers that work more exclusively with executives, professional services providers that sell, they are very tuned in to not coming across as too self-interested. And anything they believe that smacks of pitching and or trying to persuade the buyer down a certain path, they worry about being perceived as self-interested. So they worry that the buyer will doubt their intent. What they don't do is they don't insert their opinion, they don't give ideas, they don't push back when they don't think the buyer is necessarily headed down the right direction because they're worried about how they'll be perceived. That is a problem. That is something that they need to get rid of. That's something they need to change. Because, let's take my dad for example. I really trust my dad. There are few people in the world that I believe has my best interest in mind more than my dad. But my dad's the first person to say, I don't know, Mike, I don't really know if you should do that. I don't know, Mike, I don't know if you should buy that car. Geez, Mike, is that the best idea? It never bothers me because I know he's not doing it because he wants something for him. He wants something for me. So if you can grow these things in tandem, if you can establish the trust and you have that trust, that is something that you should hold in great stewardship. But the people that are good at bringing forth their ideas, bringing forth their capabilities, bringing forth a voice to the table that really does fulfill the promise that so many companies have that says, we're not just going to bring you products and services, we're going to help you make better decisions. We're going to help you succeed more. Working with us isn't just plugging in what we have, it's 1 + 1 = 3. And the ability to bring that all together requires you to bring your smarts to the table and to change the nature of the dialogue at times in ways that get better success. But you have to be able to embrace that kind of conflict. And at the same time, if you want to embrace that kind of conflict, you have to do that under the umbrella of trust, or else, regardless of how right you are, you're going to be doubted too much, and perhaps rightly so, if you haven't established that your intent is to help them succeed over and above necessarily trying to make a particular sale.
I think, and this goes right to our friend Charlie Green's research, right? The more self-oriented you are, the less trusted you will be. Mm-hmm. But if your intent really is to deliver great value to them, to help the client get the outcomes that they want, then you're obligated to push in a certain direction if that's the right choice, right?
Yeah, or else they can't trust that, you know, you're going to say what's on your mind. Sometimes they're like, don't hold back. Don't make me pull it out of you. You should be able to bring that forward. It should flow. And we use the word intent in Charlie's, the world's guru on trust. And we look at two different parts of intent. There is the clarity of purpose, which means I don't have a hidden agenda. So when buyers believe that you don't have a hidden agenda, the agenda is what you say, then they don't have to doubt that you're trying to do something else by doing this. You're just doing this. The second one is virtue of purpose, that it's the right thing, that I won't do anything to you that could have a detrimental effect. I'm going to bring things forth that in 6 months you'll say to me, I'm glad we did that. Good idea. So no hidden agendas. And having the virtue of purpose of helping you succeed before just closing any individual sale, it's going to shoot your trust levels way up. And they're going to seek you out for advice more often because they know you're not going to just feed them some line because it can help you in some way.
It's interesting. Before we move on to the next question, I recognize both of us end up working with C-level executives. And they really expect you to bring real candor to the conversation. And if you don't bring real candor, you're not valuable to a C-level executive at all. I mean, you can't hold back when you know, hey, there's something being missed here. I've got to share this with you. Even if it makes you uncomfortable and you don't like what I say, I've got to say it, because that's how you become a trusted advisor. I mean, and something very different than just a sales rep. Is that your experience?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's right on.
Let me get into this a little bit here, because this is going to make a few people apoplectic when we start talking about how your research comes in conflict with the challenger sale. And your buyers suggested, and I'll let you correct however I frame this up if I don't get this right. Let's just say that words have meanings, and it wasn't so much that they perceived challenging was important when it came to sharing insights, But there was a different word, and it was more of a collaboration. And I've believed for a long time that there's a continuum that we operate on in sales, and there's conflict on one end, which we're always in about pricing when we negotiate, and there's collaboration on the other end. And the more we can collaborate with a customer, the easier it is to avoid conflict and the greater likelihood we have of winning. What did your research show, and where did that come into conflict with what Challenger Sale Research shows?
Well, we've already covered the two biggest areas of conflict, but I think it bears mention again. I think that, you know, to make the point, the end of solution sales, which in my experience, people remember the headlines much more often than they remember the detail. And that's my experience, and that's probably kind of obvious. But people take and translate things like titles and headlines into meaning, and they well should. So the end of solution sales, I think, is doing the world a disservice, as well by saying selling is not about relationships. Is it really about relationships? Well, that would mean that there's a that one equals the other. It's not one equals the other, but having relationships is a crucial part of sales success. And to dismiss it like that, I think is I think that's a bad idea.
Me too.
So the other thing that we found is that. And this is something that we think in terms of, you know, really liking what we read in the Challenger book. A lot of the sub points that they make takes control of the sale, tailors for resonance, is willing to talk about money, embraces a certain amount of tension in the discussion so they can ask difficult questions and disagree when it's time to disagree with someone. Those are all great points. Those are common points in much sales discussion for years and years. But the way that they are packaged in terms of calling it a challenger versus not being a relationship builder or something else, I think is a problem. So the construct of their five types of sales reps, I think that it creates a certain amount of false contrast that is more for effect than anything else. Happy to talk about that if you like. But the big thing is the connotation. So when we talk to buyers about challenging versus collaborating, they didn't like challenge, and they didn't like the feeling of being challenged. It creates a certain amount of standoffishness. And I think that a difficulty in implementation from those folks that are using Challenger are running into that. But the buyers really love the idea of collaborating, and not only do they love the idea of collaborating when we spoke to them, before we spoke to them, when they were just taking, doing the research with us, that collaboration itself shot way to the top in the differences that the winners versus the second place finishers had. So we were surprised. I mean, we looked at 42 different factors, and collaboration was the number two difference. The number one difference was educated me on new ideas and perspectives. So if you think about it, it's that they brought something to the table as a person, not just a good product or service, but they brought new ideas and perspectives to the table, and they collaborated with me to let me part own that and shape that. So so I have a hand in bringing it forward. When someone has a hand in bringing something forward, they feel like it's theirs. They're not being sold to. And they're a part of that solution, not an audience to it.
Isn't this part of a relationship of value, though? I mean, I'm worth doing business with because I'm bringing you ideas, and I'm going to help you figure out how to move your business forward in a time where we've got commoditization, disintermediation, two recessions. People are being asked to do more with fewer resources than at any time, and you show up and say, I've got a plan, I think I have something that I can help you, let's collaborate. And I shared this story with Dan Pink on this podcast when I interviewed him. There's my story, your story, and our story, and I think the more we can make it our story together and shape this story about how we're going to go from where we are to where we need to go together, the easier it is to win. And I see those as attributes of a professional salesperson that help build a relationship of value.
Yeah, and so that brings us to the major disagreement, that some of the sub things are similar in terms of what it takes to collaborate versus what it takes to challenge, but they are more antonym than synonym in tone. And so given 100 salespeople and you tell them to go collaborate with buyers to figure out what's going on and to craft something that's going to work for them and to help them get to a better place than they are today versus go challenge them to do that, I think that they're likely to be implemented very differently. And you know, I know where we keep talking about this idea of relationships. It's probably because we feel so strongly about it. But I think it's those labels that are more important than anything else. The challenger folks describe a relationship builder as that they focus on developing strong personal and professional relationships. They're generous with time. They strive to meet every customer's need. They work hard to resolve tension in the commercial relationship. That sounds more like a friend or a bartender or a cruise director or a friendly customer service person than it does what most people would call a relationship builder. I mean, imagine we were talking with someone from one of the big four accounting firms that was a partner or one of the major consulting firms and say, well, what do you think drives your success in being able to have such a large practice? What they say to us all the time is the strength of my relationships. And if I said, well, describe what's a relationship, do you think they'd say I'm generous with my time, I try not to have conflict, harmony is important, I try to solve their every need, if there's a, you know, any kind of problem, I go in and fix it? Oh my God, they would say, you know, what do you think I am, five? I mean, you know, friends are for Saturday. And what they do describe is the strength of the relationship, the sum mix of the difference that they make, the trust that they built, the strength of the collaboration. And
the business outcomes.
Yeah, so that's, you know, the difference that they make for them for sure. And that, you know, working with them creates a better future than without them. And so those are the kinds of things that people describe as important in relationships, not harmony and time generosity. So, you know, You might think, well, you know, that's just a, you know, slight difference in labeling and definition. Well, it's not a slight difference. It's a major difference. And I think that I think it's important because, again, people are just going to read it's not about relationships. And if they try to do pieces and parts of what we're talking about without the trust, without the relationships, without the solutions, you know, they're just going to get killed out there.
I agree with you. I think it's the relationship that allows you to bring those insights in the first place. And it's that trust that allows that idea to be greeted without having somebody have their hands up saying, wait a second, what are you talking about? Let me close this by asking you, this is a tough question, I apologize. I'm just going to ask you to sum this up. If you've got professional salespeople and non-professional salespeople listening to this, what would you tell them to do differently if you could sum it up? And you've got 3 points there. Could you sum it up? And I would do 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah, sure. So we already talked about one. The first one is connect. You got to connect with people. That will help to remind you that the relationships are important. And you have to connect the dots between understanding of needs and crafting a solution. If you can do that, you've got the price of entry. And that is core stuff in relationship and solution selling. It doesn't get you the win, but it doesn't get you, but without it, you get kicked out. The second part, and we talked about persuasion and bringing your ideas to the table and staking your claim to a position if you think that it's the most helpful to them, that the second one, so if the first one is connect, the second one is convince. You have to be willing to convince them and convince them of 3 things. The first one is that, of course, and we hear this all the time, this is nothing new, that the ROI is worth it. So you have to make and persuade, make the case and persuade that it's worthwhile to pursue this ROI. At the same time, we found that it's much more important these days to minimize the perception of risk for the buyer. So a lot of times people say to us, they were crazy not to buy that. The ROI was, you know, a slam dunk. Why didn't they see it? Well, they saw it. They just didn't believe it. So they weren't sure that it was going to happen. So instead of moving forward, they said, meh, you know, I don't know if I really want to stake my name to it because what if it falls apart? So they need to convince of maximum return, minimum risk, and the last one is they need to convince that they're the best choice. And so they need to be able to differentiate from actual other sellers. So level one, connect. Level two is convince. And level three is collaborate. And it's collaborate in 2 different ways. It's collaborate in how you interact. So you need to be proactive and responsive and as well easy to buy. I know a lot of sales that are lost because the buyer said, I reached out to him and he didn't reach back. Or he said to get me that by Thursday, and Thursday came and went. More sellers than you might think are dismissed on things like this because they say, if they can't get back to me now, what's it going to be like when the power shifts in their favor, when I'm already buying and I need things from them? They're selling to me now. They're trying to convince me that they're reliable, and they're already not. So you need to collaborate in how you interact. But the big thing in terms of, the thematic collaborate is to collaborate with them in the sense of pursuing a common goal. So as you said before, there's you, there's me, and then there's what we are together. So if the buyer perceives you as truly helping them to achieve something that you're working on together, we found them to be much more successful and be in the winner's circle much more often than those that aren't. So the 3 points: connect, convince, and collaborate, and you'll be doing what the winners are doing more often than the second place finishers.
Awesome. Thanks so much for your time and for sharing this. Where do people go to get this research? Do you have a landing page?
Yes. Well, you can go to www.raingroup.com. And right there on the front, you'll be able to click on research in the menu bar, and you'll find it. So if you just go to www.raingroup.com, you will be able to find this research very, very easily.
I'll put a link there, too. And what if people want to get a hold of you, Mike? What's the best way for them to do that?
You can just Google Rain Group, and you'll get our telephone number. If you fill out the contact form, that'll get over to me. You can email me at mschultz@raingroup.com. It's mschultz@raingroup.com. And you can also, of course, find me easily on LinkedIn at mschultz50 and Twitter at mike_schultz.
All right. Thanks a lot for your time.
No, thanks so much for having me. It was great talking to you.
And that was Mike Schultz from Rain Group, and you can find him at raingroup.com and also on Twitter at Mike_Schultz. I'm Anthony Iannarino, and you can find me at thesalesblog.com. And when you get there, make sure you do sign up for my Sunday newsletter. It's the best content I produce each week. Thanks for being here, and I will see you next week in the arena.